Okay, so I'm here with Chaz Palminteri, who has most recently appeared in Yonkers Joe. Chaz, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, thank you.
First off, I had a kind of general big baggy question to start this conversation with. Robert Mitchum once suggested that good film acting is the degree to which an actor can drift into the landscape. Essentially, the actor establishes a particular tempo, moving at the speed of the picture so that the actor moves almost in motion with the props and the settings and the environment. And this comes to mind in looking at your performance in Yonkers Joe, because often you are standing in the kitchen with this particular tempo in mind, sitting down reading a newspaper with this particular tempo in mind. So I must ask you to what degree this particular question concerns you as an actor.
Well, I was very fortunate. I had a director who really knew the character very well because his father was Yonkers Joe. So all I did was listen to him talk to me about his dad. And once he told me, and I would talk to him about this and about how a person feel, how did he do this, how did he feel about that? And then it just clicked. It just hit me, and I just said, okay, Yonkers Joe is in his own world, and the world moves around him.
Yeah.
You know, and I just kind of like just slipped right into it. I just did the research on it and felt really comfortable with it.
What was the degree of research that you did? Did you essentially uncover a set of, I suppose, facial semantics and the like and gestures?
Not facial things. Mostly the thing of where Yonkers' mind is always working, always scheming, always working. Even in the midst of just sitting down having eating, he's constantly thinking about, gee, I got to get money for later. I got to scheme this. I got to scheme that. And he doesn't really bring people close to him, you know. Like the thing that Yonkers used to say is like, you know, I love people. I just don't want them around all the time, you know. So I think that detachment that this person had, for whatever reason, I was able to slide right into it.
Huh. Joe's eye contact is very interesting in the sense that you have him looking away constantly, on looking around to make sure that everything's okay. He's checking out the situation almost all the time. But the interesting thing is that this is both in his domestic scenario as well as when he is working a scenario as a mechanic. And I'm
that's
curious.
That's very intuitive, yes.
Yeah, well, I'm curious how this developed and how this was this something you worked out with Rob or something that came into being with your preparation?
I think that came into being with my preparation, where I just felt he was never at ease. He was never at ease. Even like a good mechanic, that's what you call these guys. They know when a blow is going down. A blow is when you're going to get caught. Before it happens, they said, uh-oh, something's going down. And that's why his eyes were always traveling. And even when he was with Christine Lottie, who plays my girlfriend, she even says to him, what are you looking at? Come on, you know, what are you doing? You know, he just cannot get close to a person. And that was a choice that I made, yeah.
Huh, interesting. I wanted to ask you about the notion of text. You're a writer, yeah. So as a result, I think you'd probably have a greater awareness of how specific the text is. And I'm curious if you offered any kind of embellishments or improvements on the text, or if you're the kind of guy who looks at a script and says, okay, we have to go ahead and do this as written because this is specifically what the writer intended.
I never read a script where I had to say, this is so perfect, we have to do it as written. I mean, I've never read one by any writer where anything couldn't be better but a little change here and there. You know, you get on the set, it changes. You meet with a different actor, it changes. The tempo of the scene all of a sudden doesn't work because of a certain blocking. So in any movie I ever did, there was always something that we made it better, or, you know, we thought we made it better anyway. In this movie, there's a couple of suggestions I made? Yeah, sure. But he wrote a hell of a good script. I mean, but as the star of the film and as the director, we talked over certain things. I made some suggestions. Some of them he liked, some of them he didn't use.
So, what specific suggestions?
I thought that Christine Lottie's character had to be a little more fleshed out. I thought that was important. Some of the early scripts, she wasn't as fleshed out. We didn't know her journey, and I thought the character was too important for us not to know her journey. Either you forget her altogether and make her just a real subordinate character, or you make something. And I thought we should make a really more, and Robert did that, where our relationship became more powerful and more strong, and I think that helped the movie.
Going back to the issue of preparation, perhaps you could talk about in light of this particular movie. I'm curious if there is such a thing as over-preparation for you, for a performance like this, a performance elsewhere, where if you plan something too much, then you're going to lose the spontaneity, you're going to lose the naturalness of human behavior and the like.
Right.
Was this been a scenario with you? Have you had to...
That never happened to me.
Huh.
Because I don't over-plan things. I plan it, I know where I'm going, I have a roadmap. Okay, and then I'm able to change that roadmap if I have to. You have to, because you meet with a director and you meet with the other actors, and all of a sudden you get on the set and it's not like you thought it was going to be. It changes. For some reason, an actor does something else and it doesn't match what you felt like you should do. All right, now we got to talk about this now. Is this going to work? Maybe it works better, or maybe it works worse. So if you think that your way might still be better, that's when you have to talk to the director and see, well, I'm feeling this way. And that's why movies, sometimes people leave movies, the artistic differences, that doesn't work, you know. I usually try to make it work, you know.
Yeah.
I hope I can.
Are there such situations in which you felt hamstrung by a particular director's decision, or do you just simply work within those particular confines?
I've always been able to work with directors who respect my opinion, and no director wants an actor to be uncomfortable.
Sure.
To be uncomfortable. I mean, once you say those words to a director, I'm just not feeling comfortable here. I feel, then he's willing to listen to anything you got to say.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a director, you know, I've directed movies. If an actor's telling me he's uncomfortable, I got to make him comfortable.
Yeah.
No matter what. You know, so we have to make this thing right. If you're not feeling good, whoa, let's talk about it. So we work on it, and either sometimes the director could help you by saying, well, you're feeling uncomfortable because, and then he tells you the reason, then you go, oh, that's right, yeah. And then you're not uncomfortable anymore. Or we really got to change the whole thing.
I'm curious as to what level the camera factors into a particular performance. There's one sequence in Michael Lerner's office in this in which your head is cut off, and as such, you have to act more with your body in this particular scene.
Mm.
How do you adjust, I mean, what degree do you adjust your performance in relation to where the camera is? Or is this something you is probably overstated in examining, or actually just simply acting?
No, I think that's a good question, but it's different in certain situations. Like a scene like that where they're just shooting the bottom of me and not my head, I'm looking down, I'll act like they're shooting my face because I want it to be natural. Sometimes when you're doing a master, I'll do a little less because I it's not like I'm doing less because I'm being lazy. I'm just doing a little less when I say, well, I'll save that for the title one. And then if it's here, I'll do something more, because now I have to work in the confines of a smaller space, you see. If it's the wide shot, I can move my hands or move, you know. But once they tell me, okay, Chaz, we're moving up to here, so I make sure I don't move my head a lot. I make sure I stay focused. So out of that whole take, he might just grab certain pieces that he really needs. So as a writer and as a director, I kind of see the movie sometimes.
Yeah. Are there specific situations, though, in which you're not concerned with where the camera is, or are you always concerned in every single take that you do? You know exactly where the camera is. You need to know where the camera is.
I pretty much know where the camera is.
Okay.
I know where the camera is and what I think I have to do. I do, yes.
I also wanted to ask if wardrobe has been a consideration for you for a performance. Like in this movie, you often have shirts in which the button or the top two buttons are frequently undone.
Right.
And whether something like this helps you get in tune with a character like Joe.
Yeah, I think wardrobe helps a lot. You know, he wasn't a great... He liked to dress, but he didn't have money to dress. So I think it's important to wear certain clothes that fit the character, you know, the feeling. Once you get in those clothes, you feel differently. When you're wearing a $5,000 suit and beautiful tie, you feel differently. You feel like a boss if you're going to be a boss. When you wear those kind of types of clothes, you feel differently.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that's important.
There's a scene at the horse track in which you play the entire scene with a newspaper under your arm. Mm. And there are a number of things going on in this scene. Joe is trying to bet on the horses. He's also trying to make sure everything is okay with Janice and his son. Mm. And the idea of having the newspaper under your arm while Joe is going through all of these internal concerns, it creates an interesting limitation. And I'm curious how props like this are both a blessing and a concern for you, and how they enhance a particular moment, whether the newspaper under your arm may have been your decision or Rob's or what?
I don't remember whose decision it was, to be honest with you. I cannot remember if it was mine or Rob's. I don't remember. But if I had it, I used it. I said, all right, well, I'm going to use this prop right now and use it. You know, props are there to, you know, as long as you could use them and make them something in the scene, then they're fine. You know, sometimes they can get in the way.
Okay. You know,
sometimes they can get in the way, but I try not to let it get in the way.
Yeah. You're in the process of doing a national tour of A Bronx Tale.
Right, the Broadway show.
Yeah, the Broadway show, which is now touring around the country.
Yes.
And this is very interesting because I know that you have indicated that one of the reasons you did this is because you wanted to allow people who didn't have the money to go to New York to see the particular show.
Absolutely.
And you have very affordable ticket prices, I know. You know, Miami is 18 and Arizona is 23. It's the lowest prices. But simultaneously, this brings up a larger issue about theater in this economic crisis. Mm. I mean, how do you think theater can carry on when, even though you're willing to go out on the road and make sure that regular people can go see your performance, a lot of people can't afford to go to shows. And then there's this economic crisis. How can theater survive given this clear socioeconomic indicator?
Well, first of all, I mean, theater survived so far with everything. Yeah. And I think people, you know, will it survive as big as it did, you know, years ago, 30 years ago? You know, not right now it won't. But, you know, I think a good play and a good show survives somehow. The problem with it is a lot of people don't want to write for the theater no more because there's not that much money in it. And so what happens is everybody wants to write for television and movies, you know.
Yeah.
But the real, you know, I mean, before there was film, before there was television, there was theater. That's how it started. Theater is the essence of where everything has started. People getting on stage. The Greeks started it by telling a story between two people so they would observe the people on stage. It was more like for their learning, it was almost like a psych class. Mm-hmm. And then someone said, hey, we should charge money for this.
Yeah.
And that's how theater actually really started.
Sure.
So to me, that's the essence of an actor. It's not like a play. I mean, it's not like a movie where you do five lines, you do cut, you do five lines, you do cut. This is like 2 hours on stage, just you and the audience, man.
Yeah.
There's nothing like it.
But you have probably had to make some concessions to ensure that regular people could see A Bronx Tale for this, I'm sure.
Right. Well, we had to lower some prices, and I want people to see it. And there's a whole new generation of people who never got to see the original show.
Yeah.
And I thought it was very important that people do get to see this, because the idea is like the wasted talent theme of A Bronx Tale. The saddest thing in life is wasted talent.
Sure.
And I think people should see the show.
Well, Chaz, thanks so much for taking the time out to talk.
Right,
it was a pleasure chatting with you.
Thanks.
All right.
All right.
Okay, so I am here with Robert Celestino, who is the writer and director of Yonkers Joe. Rob, how are you doing?
Very well. Very well, Ed. Thank you for having me.
First off, I had a kind of question about the casino heist genre as a whole. I mean, in watching your film, I was very much reminded of the film The Cooler, which also juxtaposed an unusual relationship within the sort of casino heist formula. And I'm wondering if it really sort of takes these days a kind of unusual secondary plot or kind of a primary plot that's split between the traditional casino heist formulas as well as something new, like, for example, the relationship between the father and son in this particular film. Is this kind of one of the motivating factors that led to the beginnings of this particular film?
Are you asking me how the script, the story, manifested? Is that
well? That, and also just the idea of implementing an unusual father-son story amidst a casino story. Elements that we do know how this kind of led to, you know, the genesis of the film.
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, again, I think if a story really comes from a place that's creative, that it can never really be derivative or anything else like that, even though it may hold a specific genre. Yonkers Joe, there was a man named Yonkers Joe, and that man was my father.
Yeah.
So You know, so I knew about this milieu and I knew about this subculture that exists. And what's beautiful about, I think, Yonkers Joe is that it's not about these big million-dollar con men. These guys are blue-collar hustlers.
Sure.
They go to clam bakes and stag parties. So going to a casino is usually off limits to them, but situations occur or arise where that opportunity comes. But what really, when I approach a screenplay personally, I try to come up with something that is just impossible. If I say to you, Ed, I'm going to put a mentally challenged person into the most sophisticated surveillance operation on the planet for any commercial enterprise, such as a casino, and have him take that off, have him go in there and rob them. Would that sound likely? You know, we started with that premise. And then, you know, then I start to break it down. I start to say, well, how could this be possible? How could we really make this thing happen?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was how it, you know, it came about. You know?
Gotcha. I know that the script started off as a journal that you had kept going about Fast Jack Farrell and Benny Jumbo in your teens. So it seems to me that you started both in terms of your father, which you just mentioned here, but also this journal observing these types of guys. But I'm wondering, at what point do you have to essentially, I guess, throw off the shackles of reality and use powers of invention or rely upon your intuitive insights about human behavior to make something a little bit different here?
Yeah, good question. I'm never interested in reality. I'm only interested in what's believable mm-hmm. as a filmmaker. That's the thing. I'm tough. So if I can believe it, then I can, you know, I have confidence that others will. And when I was watching these guys go to these clam bakes and switching the dice in front of 50 people, and I always saw them. They were wonderful when they actually came time to switch the dice or something. But I saw them going into their pockets. Yeah. I saw them taking out the dice. And I remember saying to one of them one time, I said, you know, I saw what you did.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to stand behind him with a cape, you know? And he replied, well, you were looking. And I says, well, isn't everybody? They says, no. A player at the table can't watch you every second out of every hour, out of every minute at a game. And that 1 second where he's not watching is when we move. And when they do see something, we know how to make false moves. We'll go back into our pocket and pull out candy,
yeah.
You know? And they what they do is they put them to sleep. They put the player to sleep by making these kind of false moves and innocent. So they're... These guys almost have like a force power. They can read minds. They know when the player is going to give them a blow, which is a way of them saying catching them, before the player even knows he's going to do it.
Yeah.
And that's what I tried to depict in the movie, in that scene in the clam bake, where they were all looking at him saying, oh, no, not this
yeah.
again. You
know? Yeah, except at that one moment where they do, in fact, catch on. I'm wondering, how many of those moments did you observe? Because certainly you weren't the only person looking and seeing the slick moves and the dice behind the hand as well. I mean, you know, maybe it was just a matter of, I guess, throwing a particular person off or at least categorizing a particular person. Like, okay, that person's more likely to be lost in his own... accumulation of money, so he won't notice the more interesting things that are going on that are not being seen and the like. And it almost seems to me that this is a very good skill set that you can transpose to be a filmmaker. You know?
Yeah. Well, it is. You really, as a director, you know, you want to be able to see into a behavior. You want to be able to. Qualify a temperament.
Yeah.
You know, so this is what these mechanics do at a table. And there's a difference between a mechanic and a hustler. A polished mechanic is someone who spends hours and hours and years practicing, perfecting his craft so that he can execute these moves under deep scrutiny. Mm-hmm. But I've seen many times where these guys, because they really evaluate themselves based on getting the money. They can't say, well, it was too tough or this and that. So I've seen situations where one time they caught a guy, and these guys, you got to remember, they're drunk. And usually the ones that give them the toughest times are the ones not even playing, because there's 25 people playing, but 50 watching.
Yeah.
And they were going to hang the guy. Yeah. They actually had a rope, and they were putting up, and they were going to hang the guy, and they had the rope around his neck, and then, you know, the committee came over. There was another time where a guy, they had a guy, and they were burning his face with a cigar, burning holes in his face.
Wow.
And a priest walked by, and the mechanic said, Father, help me.
Yeah.
And the priest walked by and said, that's what you get for cheating.
Well, if you have this skill of observing the con, in effect, this leads me to ask you about how you were able to convince casinos to shoot in their particular lair and reveal the eyes in the sky? I mean, were there specific conditions as to what you could shoot and what you couldn't shoot? I mean, how did this work? Or did you actually have to concoct a casino set of some sort?
Well, let me, I'm going to get to that, but let me first address the word con. I really want this film to make the distinction between con men and mechanics.
Okay.
Because these guys never—they don't take people into confidence and then to double cross them.
Sure.
What they do is they go right in and make the moves at the table in front of them. And the movie does. Yonkers Joe, you know, he's a thief. He admits he's a thief, but he's not a con man. Like you can see if you saw the movie about the Miami guys. He really doesn't want to. He says, I don't mind robbing these guys. I'll rob anyone, but I don't do it with my mouth. I do it with my hands. Mm-hmm. And for the pragmatic reasons is that, you know, he knows that these double cross moves always come back to haunt you. They're never clean. So I really want to make just like the same way I want to make a distinction between mechanics and magicians. Whereas magicians live in front of an audience, mechanics live in the shadows.
Fair enough. But beyond that distinction, what about persuading casinos to shoot? Were there specific terms that were laid down? I mean, I know this has been an issue for other filmmakers, particularly when you were talking about a film that does, in fact, expose certain security elements, which I would presume that some of them would actually be kind of kept under wraps because they don't want to actually reveal everything about themselves, and you probably had to do a little bit of invention to get this verisimilitude, to get this believability we were talking about before.
I don't know of too many filmmakers that get to shoot in casinos because casinos are not in the business of making movies. They're in the business of making money.
Yeah.
So we were very fortunate as some of our investors were casino owners.
Ah, okay.
So not only did we get to shoot in the casinos, but we got to shoot it during the day. And they would rope off a section to us, and they really opened up everything to us. There's five people in a casino that work in a casino that are allowed into the surveillance rooms.
Wow.
So we were allowed to go into the surveillance rooms just to look around. We didn't actually shoot in there.
Yeah.
We built that set.
Sure.
But we did match it identical, you know, to what we've seen. So, and also, you know, they're not ever going to bring a suspected mechanic up into the surveillance room. So what they do have is they have an outer room where they would show somebody something in case there was a question, like they did in Yonkers Joe.
Sure.
But the surveillance room was actually in another room where Yonkers got to take a peek at, you know?
Yeah.
Some
suspension here to move the plot. Again, this goes back to the other question about how much you stray from reality. In this case, certainly you had to in service of the narrative. But perhaps when you were writing the script, were there questions that you were asking about, I kind of need to move the narrative along, so there's a trade-off here. I mean, what criteria was there in terms of I have to advance the narrative, but there's this trade-off in believability. Was this an issue for you when you were devising the script?
Well, that's always a balancing act. Ironically, in this script and movie, it really didn't come about that much. Pretty much everything that happens in the movie pretty much can happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the movie, the thing at the end and all that, all can really happen. In fact, when the security people or surveillance people were reading the script, they said when this movie comes out, casinos will probably start putting black light gel in their dice. And that was where I had to kind of be inventive a bit because loaded dice are very easy to see. That's why they make the dice clear so you can see the loads in them. But if you have something in them that you don't have to look at the dice, like black light gel, then there's no reason to even look.
Sure.
You know, so...
So this was largely devised then, both the idea of the extra dice, the extra die that is thrown onto the table and the black light. These were your particular inventions. Where did you determine any news stories or any of your observations that would, create this seemingly plausible ruse or what?
Years and years ago, I was talking to somebody about, you know, I was presenting this story to a friend of mine and I said, you know what? A guy could probably go in to the casino if he's good enough and switch the dice. And he said to me, it can't happen. I said, why? And he says, well, they mark their dice.
Yeah.
So you can't. And I didn't know whether he was telling the truth or not, but it made enough sense that it had me thinking. Now, they really don't mark their dice.
Sure.
But the thing was, it started to have me thinking. I said, well, how can you use that? And I don't want to give away the ending of the movie, but the other move that he actually does, it came from what I was first telling you about how do you get this impossible scenario, how do you make that believable?
Got it.
So I had to come up with something that was easy enough for do, but at the same time, you can get away with.
Yeah,
you know?
But also understandable to the audience.
Right.
I do want to ask you, since we're starting to kind of run out of time, about Christine Lottie, because I know that she was cast while the film was being made. Was there another actress that you had in the role? Why did this happen? I mean, the last minute casting like this. I'm very curious.
No, there was nobody ever really cast. We were still... And the producers wanted Christine right from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some conflicts of interest with schedules and stuff like that, right? So we took a real gamble.
Yeah.
You know, hoping we can free up Christine at that time, because none of us wanted to hire anybody until, you know, we saw what was going on with Christine, because we knew she was so perfect.
Yeah.
And the relationship between her and Chaz had such chemistry. And also, it made that, you know, our audience doesn't come and see a film because of the story, because of the actors, because of the plot, because of the character development. An audience comes to see a movie because of the relationships. And if the relationships have to pay off, they got to be solid relationships that pay off. And I had to believe the relationship between Yonkers Joe and Janice.
Sure.
And Christine brought that.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, too, because I had noticed that she was gripping her necklace throughout the particular movie, and we have this explanation late in the film. So this leads me to believe, if she had very little time to prepare, 2 days, as I understand it, how little ticks like gripping the necklace came about. Were these just essentially like, hey, we got to shoot this movie. Christine, can you grip that necklace? Or what happened with this?
That came from a brilliant actor really delving into the spine of the character. She had this symbol of this graduation ring.
Yeah.
That meant something to her, if you see the movie. So every once in a while when she got in it, she just took hold of that ring. It wasn't her necklace. It was the ring hanging
the
from
ring,
her necklace.
Yeah, gotcha.
And in the script, we had more payoff for that ring where the kid, you know, he does look at, you know, and then she thinks he's looking down other places. But it was a nice piece of business that she worked in so that when she gets to talk about the ring, we kind of let it work on levels that don't have to be ostentatious.
Yeah.
Or out there. All symbols should be in the background.
Yeah.
You know, and...
And yet there are symmetry to a lot of symbols in this. For example, the bathrobe at the very beginning that carries on later on in the hotel. There was also, of course, the moment where we see Joe Sr. gripping the top bar in the gym. And later on, we see Joe Jr. gripping the top bar in Vegas. I mean, certainly things like this were planned on your part. And I'm curious as to how much they were outlined in the script or whether they came about through the filmmaking process or whether they came about through being at the location seeing, oh, well, hey, this has a bar, that has a bar. I mean, how much of this was planned?
Well, the hand was something that was planned because Yonkers is... power comes from his hands.
Yeah,
everything he does is from his hands. So we wanted to work that in, and you're very observant to grab that the bathroom, also the pink. Mm-hmm. You know, early on when she's talking
That's
about
true.
The person's body, we're talking about pink. So these things need to be. There's a lot of things that you want to layer, and that's the stuff you kind of do as a director later on working with the DP and all. And you want to layer these visual elements that work. That way, we do the same thing with sound.
Sure,
you know, laying that down. So yeah, those things that you mentioned were things that we did think about. Yeah,
the tell signs and the various communications among Chaz and his cronies. These were in the script, or were they developed in the course of rehearsal?
You mean the
you know, something like the little touching their nose?
Oh, that's
and communicating
interesting.
To a lot, and that was a very specific
right.
behavioral kind of semantics there going
there,
on.
There's something that happened while we were shooting. While we were shooting the scene, Chaz did that.
Oh, really?
Instinctively,
mm-hmm.
And I seen him do it a couple of times. So what I said to him is, I just stopped and I said, Chaz, do that again and just say, did you see me give him the what do you do? Like, in other words, he was giving him a tell that he wanted to fall for it. But I seen him do it a couple of times. I said, now I got to use it.
Oh, interesting.
You know, so that was one of those times where we just grabbed it on the set. You know?
Gotcha. Well, we have to jam, unfortunately. But Rob, thanks very much for taking the time out of your schedule. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Same here. Thank you very much.
Where did you come from? Where did you go? Where did you come from? Cutting our dough.